I'm Mark Gagan and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise-scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Aegis London is one of the most consistently top-performing syndicates in the Lloyd's market. It's also one of the least volatile. The business has a new CEO, Alex Powell, and so it was only natural that I should invite him onto the show for a catch-up. Alex has been with Aegis since the year 2000, when it was a fledgling syndicate, so he knows this firm inside and out. To use his own phrase, he's been sheep-dipped in this business's culture. It's clear from this meeting that we shouldn't expect radical departures from Alex, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't expect Aegis London to be radical. Because this is a radical business at heart. It's found a way of putting into practice what many preach, but what is enormously difficult to do. Grow when you can, and preserve capital when you can't, and all the while maintaining a healthy balance that brings genuine diversification benefits. It's also pioneered the digitization of specialist business classes with a large degree of success, which is something many would not have predicted. In this meeting, we spend a lot of time examining the market and going over the secrets of Aegis's success. I don't want to spoil it for you, but a bit like his predecessor, David Croom Johnson, Alex seems to be a good living example of the culture he wants to engender in his staff. He's easygoing, curious, smart and charismatic, and is open and honest about his strategy and what has and hasn't worked over the years. He's not prone to hyperbole and gives a strong impression that he would be an excellent person to work for. And perhaps that's the real secret, as this business looks to make the most of what remains of the hard market. But don't take my word for it. You should hear it for yourself. Enjoy the podcast. Alex, welcome to the Voice of Insurance.
Thank you, Mark. Thrilled to have the opportunity.
Well, it's really good to have you on the show. You're relatively new in your post, and so not everybody's going to know who you are. So why don't you give us a potted history of your career to date?
Absolutely. Well, I had a rather unremarkable stint as a broker for 3 years.
But we've got something in common.
Absolutely. I think I lasted even less than you. So yes, I had a short stint and then went off underwriting, joined Jansen Green Syndicate 79 as was, which became Limit. Been on the property side, what people curiously like to still refer to as DNF, but it was all property to me. And I joined Aegis in November 2000 when it was a fledgling energy syndicate.
So it was just starting?
Just starting, yeah. Employee less than number 30. So yeah, really good.
So with Jansen Green, that was a very good outfit. That was actually, as a broker, I did spend time in there, right. But with Syndicate 386 of that outfit back in those days. So that must have been a good place to start.
Really good place to start an underwriting career. Small business, very focused, lots of experience around the park. Although in property, again, that was fairly new, historical marine and energy and liability focus. So yeah, I came over here with 9 or so others from what became Limit and started helping write a property account. And then over the years, I've looked after the property, the terrorism, and our first foray into cyber before becoming the CUO in 2017.
And then you've just taken over the CEO role. Was that just within the last 6 months, isn't it?
9 months.
Nine months.
1st of July. Yeah, 1st of July last year.
Well, now you're fully settled into post. Should anyone be expecting any changes from your predecessor?
Well, I think everybody was hoping for evolution rather than revolution. I don't think there was anything fundamentally wrong with Aegis London, and David did a fantastic job. We definitely have a shared insurance DNA, so there will be a lot of similarities between the work that he did and that which I'm about to do. Certainly focused on one or two things. Performance, which has been paramount, will continue. Data, definitely a buzzword at the moment. Digitization, and of course the culture of the business. Those are the big four strategic priorities of mine.
So it's really a continuation, but I suppose it's about someone who's been with the business for over 20 years to suddenly come and change everything because you're effectively already part of the furniture anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Although, I mean, we've had a lot of new people join this business. So as much as I've been here for a long time, we've got a lot of people to bed in to a culture. Head of HR will kill me for getting this wrong, but I think we've had 50% of people here today have joined since the beginning of the pandemic.
That's really impressive, of course, because you have been growing. Aggressive is a word, it's quite a dangerous sounding word when it's applied to underwriting, but it has been fairly aggressive, the growth. Is that going to continue?
Yes, you could measure it as aggressive. It was always part of a plan.
I suppose to grow when it's right to grow.
Exactly.
And it certainly was right to grow.
Yeah, preserve capital when you need to, and then when you have the opportunity, grow. There is more to come. There's a bit more in the story. And I think some of that has come out of the situation that specialty insurance finds itself in after the last year with nothing less than Ukraine, inflation, and the reset in the reinsurance markets, which we saw at the end of the year. So that has probably prompted a bit more growth in our inwards book in 2023.
So in which case, has that affected growth plans in any way, particularly the reinsurance end of it? Does it kind of clip your wings a bit? Or was it something you were fully ahead of or aware of? Some people always seem to be slightly surprised by reinsurance renewals, and others tell me that reinsurance brokers have been preparing them for this bad news for quite a long time beforehand. But which camp were you in?
I certainly think we were well prepared. Certainly our plans didn't land as exactly as we thought they might.
So was it slightly worse or better?
Slightly worse than plan. I think we saw the tide definitely changing, but as I think you well know, and you've documented on your show, things came quite late to land. Some even passed the 1st of January renewal date. So I wouldn't say we were massively in front of it, but we certainly wouldn't say that we weren't on top of it.
So were there any kind of post-reinsurance renewal revisions to your own inwards underwriting, clipping your wings in that sort of sense, that terms and conditions and cost or attachment points had been worse than you thought they were going to be, and therefore you had to readjust? Or was your sort of planning for that 2023 business plan about right in the end in terms of price and the structure?
If we look at our original planning for 23, back when we did a 2023-year plan, that doesn't look like a good comparison. So we have had to adjust. Thankfully, there's been a bit more reaction on the inwards, things like rate change that we've seen. And we are, I think, as you know, a key property underwriter. And that has leapt ahead of any sort of plan that we might have. But I think things like retention, it's okay learning about it, adjusting for it, but you've then got to live with it. And until we have the experience, we won't know how good or bad that's been.
Because, yeah, I mean, the retention is just a number that some actuary has thrown at you, but it's only when you actually have a big loss or a sort of an event that suddenly you realize what it actually costs you as a cedent.
Yes, absolutely. But I think we were well steered both by our in-house buyer and by our reinsurance brokers. We knew roughly what to expect. But as you say, until we actually experience a loss, net losses now, the magnitude that we've been asked to, it's all just numbers on a spreadsheet.
Is it slightly more nervous as an underwriter?
I guess so, but I think we've preserved ourselves for a long time in a world where we've had relatively modest retentions for our size. So perhaps we've not felt the adjustment as keenly as others.
And from what you said earlier, it sounds like it is still the sort of insurance market where you don't get squeezed, where you are able to pass on some of these increased costs.
Yes, I think mainly because some of those other factors are in play. I mean, certainly inflation has played a huge role across specialty insurance, and that's definitely coming into play. And of course, the contraction in the cat market, which precipitated or otherwise by what's happened in the reinsurance and retro, has meant there's been a big squeeze on capacity, and that pricing has responded very positively.
What about Aegis as a business, as we know it, as this top-performing London market business, as a new broom coming in? Do you feel that it's something that there's a machine that has been constructed and that it's done, and you have to manage that machine and decide how much of each class that you're in you're going to be taking, how much, you know, and making that machine more efficient? Or are there other parts, do you think there are other strings you can put to the bow? Are there bits that you haven't built that you've felt, well, during my tenure, we'll probably, and if the market allows us to, we will try and build those? Are there other parts of the business you want to build?
Most definitely. I mean, what we have done around differentiated underwriting, which is a portfolio style play, mainly through the consortium and MGA mechanism, we haven't really added a new line of business for about 5 years. We're always looking at new lines of business. There are some that we do in a very, very small way, such as cyber, but we recognize that's a very big marketplace. So I think we're always considering new opportunities. Certainly in terms of doing own resource, where we rather traditionally hire a team and build a portfolio of business. And actually, throughout the next sort of 6 months of this year, we're doing a deeper dive on underwriting strategy to explore where some of those opportunities might exist.
They're likely to be adjacent sort of things. So it's just sort of slightly hopping over the fence
somewhere. Yeah, I think so. Never expect truly radical from us, yeah.
Okay, and you want to go somewhere where you can get very comfortable with it. And it's presumably about, is it contingent on getting the right people?
Always. I mean, I think when we unpack what has been fundamentally good about Aegis, it always starts with good people. And they've got to be a good fit for us. They've got to understand our underwriting philosophy and approach. You write through cycle in a sustainable way, being measured. That's all very important.
Sorry to interrupt in mid-flow, but this is just a reminder that you could be advertising right here, right now, and getting your message directly into the ear of key decision makers in the insurance industry. And you'll be doing it while they're absolutely in listening mode. The Voice of Insurance has just run through 300,000 downloads. If each of those had had a 60-second ad in them, that would make 83 hours of talking to the industry for a fraction of the cost of alternative media. The podcast is the medium of the future, and so is audio advertising. Contact me on mark@thevoiceofinsurance.com, and I'll do everything I can to get you started.
When I'm looking at your website, you mentioned also, in the context of growth, differentiated underwriting. Can you just explain to me what that is? Because I'm not sure I know what it is, other than if it's a strategy. Obviously, you want to be different from everybody else, and you want to be unique or be somebody that the brokers can recognise for particular skills or whatever. But I don't think you mean that, do you?
No. So, I mean, this goes back a few years when I was in the CUO seat, and I think, like a lot of Lloyd's syndicates, there are one or two sort of niche esoteric lines that you write on a consortium basis. You don't really employ an underwriter to do it. The decisions made by the underwriting exec or the CUO and others. And we were doing this for a number of years. Satellite is a really good example. So you don't employ a satellite underwriter, but you'd like to write satellite insurance. So things that don't clash with your main book of business. We found ourselves doing two or three of these type of lines in a much more an ad hoc way. We also recognized that there would be a good opportunity to write more of this style of business if you could wrap it in a strategy, give it someone as their area of responsibility to develop it. And that's exactly what we've done. So we hired an underwriter to come in, corral what we did, and then develop it. So the idea is, in similar ways to some of the beta plays that you've seen, write specific product through either consortium, MGA, those are the two preferential routes, to build out lines of business that don't clash with the main P&C of the business. So it doesn't add to the cat bet, doesn't add necessarily to the really long tail nature of what we do on the casualty side.
It's a bit like a sort of like an innovation facility, that kind of thing. And I suppose the philosophy is that if you now name it and you give it a department, then someone's responsible for it. Whereas otherwise you end up with silos and you've got a property underwriter saying, well, I wouldn't mind dabbling in this consortium over here that this broker's telling me about, but actually I don't want to risk my bonus and all this sort of stuff. Is it a way of avoiding those kinds of silo problems that you get?
Yes, certainly, because I think inevitably there is some overlap, whether it's on a distribution front or a product front. I mean, we operate a single P&L here, so we've never had such a silo problem. But it's really to enable us to be a bit more agile. So obviously, if you hire a team, what's the execution around that, getting them in, bedding them down? If you write business in a much more portfolio structured way, such as we're doing, the entry and the exit is much more simple. Obviously, there are lots of things we'd like to write through cycle, but that'll be matched with things that are a bit more opportunist.
And what sort of lines? Is it all kinds of everything?
So two great examples, micro surety and after the event insurance. I think we write about 20 different contracts at the moment, but those are two small examples.
So something that's almost by its nature incredibly diversified, and you're not putting out big lines on any single class or a single risk.
No, you're not. So you can maintain a modest risk line deployment, which keeps within the risk appetite of the overall syndicate. We've never been one for writing significant lines on anything, really.
And what's the split between consortia, which I presume are going to be sort of Lloyd's consortia, and what's the split between that and MGAs? What would you be an ideal sort of balance? Or does it what's more important is the diversificatory nature.
Exactly.
Of the
and that's the joy of it. It really doesn't matter.
Because I suppose the structure of an MGA is effectively like a consortium just written by somebody that has an active underwriter.
Yeah. I think with the MGA, the approach is to try and get into the MGAs that are very close to the product. So they could be ultra specialist rather than more, dare I say, generalist MGAs.
Yeah. So really niche stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So something to say, wow, explain to me how that works again.
Exactly.
That sounds really interesting. Do you have high hopes for that? So it sounds like that, because that was certainly, I think in another interview, you said that this was one of your sort of hopes of growth for this year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That book of business is growing significantly this year, and we have got high hopes for it. I think it is a good way to access things in the market, particularly when you find yourself rather constrained, dare I say, by things like cat exposure or long-term liability exposure. So we need things to not diversify, but diversify the book of business.
And generally new type of coverages that you haven't seen before.
Some of them are what I would call new. Some of them have been around.
Oh, like satellite is old new, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
It's really, really interesting. I presume, of course, if we don't have ways of promoting these new lines of business, of course, they'll never graduate. You know, D&O was a new line of business, 40 years ago, and now everyone pretty much writes, and then cyber's becoming that.
Yeah, definitely.
And so the cybers and D&Os of the future, presumably not going to write themselves, are they? They need someone to be backed.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think when you anchor yourself behind expertise, which is really what we're trying to do there, that's a good way to enter products or markets that are less proven, maybe.
Excellent. So as a message to all the brokers listening, that should be coming to talk to your teams.
Yes. Yeah, they need to get in touch with Lizzie Powell, who's in charge of that. Yeah.
You did mention about the Ukraine war. So more specifically, how's that been playing through in the classes that you write?
Well, significantly is the truth, both directly and indirectly. But on the direct side, we've clearly seen a reaction felt very keenly through our reinsurance purchasing and the changes that we've seen, particularly in specialty reinsurance. And then probably of all the direct classes that we write, PV war terror is probably the class most affected.
Political violence.
Yeah, exactly.
And how affected? Pricing, limits, everything. And in terms of your own limits that you're able to put out yourselves, have they changed drastically?
We haven't been constrained by that. It's a fascinating area. When I look across the underwriting metrics of the business, you'd expect, perhaps, given the world is riskier, Ukraine's happened, the specialty reinsurance market has moved, you'd probably expect PV and terror to be up there on top of your RARC chart, the highest risk-adjusted rate, but it isn't. So I think there is a little mismatch that's gone on between the hand that's been dealt with on the reinsurance side and the hand that's being played on the insurance side.
Is it because it's historically been such a profitable class, it just would take a lot longer or would take more? Would it take more of a loss to actually move that business or to, you know, to separate the long-term committed underwriters to that class away from the dabblers who would presumably, if we had a longer series of losses, they might leave?
Quite possibly right. The other thing is, with the Ukraine losses, how many of them are really landing? A lot of it's in IBNR at the moment. Yeah. So sometimes until you feel things very keenly in your P&L through materialized losses, it sometimes takes things longer to change.
Something that has really impressed me about the Aegis Group, and something that's unexpected, I think, has been your initiative to become a digital underwriter, or as digital as possible an underwriter, or a digitized underwriter with the Opal. And I go to a lot of technology events, obviously. I like to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on and all of that. And sometimes it has surprised me to see Aegis members of staff popping up and living in that community. So it's something that I would very much applaud, and it's something that has been a great success of yours. How far do you think that can go? I mean, because it's already a very significant part of your business.
Well, thank you for the plaudits. A little bit of luck, a lot of judgment has got us there. We had, in our first product going out on the Opal platform, all wrapped up in our digital trading team, we had a lot of early success.
Is it because it was the right product? Or?
Right product and a simple product. And thankfully, a product that people actually want to buy, which I think can be difficult when you're in the insurtech space. You might have all the great tech and all the great ideas, but you might have fundamentally the wrong thing that people want to buy. So I think that has really played well for us, that we've had good success by selling a simple product to a lot of people that want to buy it. And we got the underwriting right, which
obviously
again,
didn't suddenly create tons of losses out of nowhere, which is
no. And I mean, we were doing it in the analog world, and the key was just to transfer it to the digital world and give it scale. So we've been thrilled that that has happened and that there's more in the pipeline, which is great.
What was the first product?
So it's a deductible buy-down product for catastrophe perils, yeah.
Yeah, but that could be quite painful.
Could be. But by and large, you're deploying very small limits. It's like any insurer, really. You've just got to manage exposure, manage spread, and control pricing.
Certainly, back in my broken days, it was always the people who did deductible buybacks were always the larger-than-life characters, generally.
Yeah. Oh, that's very sweet. I mean, that's so. When I was an analog underwriter, I certainly did a lot of that.
But often, actually, they're probably the best traders because they knew how to price it the right. And so the client would always buy it, and actually, the client really wanted it. That's why they were asked to quote it, and therefore they were happy to pay for it.
Yeah, and thanks to the broader distribution we've been able to give it, it's being much more embedded in placements. Not just geographically, but
it's easy to access.
Exactly.
You don't have to spend too long quoting it or you know, sort of messing around with it. And the broker can pretty much have the price there and then and present it as a part of the quote of the major program.
Yeah. I think 40 seconds to get a quote and bound policy or something like
that. That's really, really good. Yeah. I suppose the definition of simplicity isn't a deductible buyback product. How much more sophisticated do you think you'll be able to get with these?
I think there's so much scope, and a bit like you, Tom Squires, who heads up our digital trading, hangs out at some of these techie events and is constantly approached by people. So to date, we've taken our own products and put them on the platform. And I guess part of the next step is taking other people's products and putting it down the same channel. So if we can imagine a suite of products, and it doesn't have to say Aegis, we're very happy with white labeling, a suite of products inside the Opal platform is something that we can certainly imagine.
So you could take over the whole Lloyd's market. And you should be the digital platform for the whole Lloyd's market, it sounds like.
I don't think that's...
Your one already works.
We do know it works. I mean, I have to admit, you know, we have struggled slightly with the second album, as it were. So the subsequent products haven't rocketed off the shelves as quickly as the first. But we've learned an awful lot on our digital journey.
And the main lesson would be keep it really simple.
keep it simple, absolutely, and also recognize what you're trying to do. I think certainly when we began to get a head of steam on the digital, we thought, bit of a disruptor, we can reduce expense, we can lower acquisition cost. And really, we headed off down a slightly wrong path there. No matter how good our product is, we weren't going to do that. But what it does do, it's an enabler and gets access for both brokers and us. So that's much more important.
So the objective is just to do more profitable insurance business.
Absolutely.
And then make friends with more brokers out there.
Yeah, exactly.
What about the expenses? Surely you must get some expense wins because you have to have all the development costs and then presumably you get to pay that back.
I think we're realizing that on the growth upside. So I think traditional model, you want to grow a class of business, you're probably adding more underwriters. Digital model, you don't need to add any more underwriters. You just need broader distribution, more penetrative into the distribution
chain.
Get
it in front of more people.
Exactly. And we moved to a net pricing model as well, which I suspect most underwriters would really like to do in reality, but can't because the market dictates.
Then you're sharpening the broker's pen there on his own commission if he wants to get the business.
If they want to do that, absolutely. Let them be the arbiter of that.
That's really good. So no one knows what your expense ratio is, and so it's none of their business, and your price is your price.
Exactly.
So the lesson is not to go with an objective as a CEO to say, why have we got a 12-point expense ratio? Why don't we just turn that into 4 and then that'll be great? That's the wrong objective.
Yeah.
That might be a byproduct.
Absolutely. I think so. And I think early on, we got quite hung up on the whole cost and expense thing. And again, probably a modest distraction from what we were really trying to do, which was get a really good product and get it broadly distributed.
Very refreshing to hear that, actually, because perhaps sometimes we are too narrowly focused, particularly in the aggregate, perhaps within the Lloyd's market. And maybe it's rightly so. You know, the expenses had ballooned and therefore needed to be trimmed. But at the same time, looking at technology as always being the obvious answer to do that, you're saying that doesn't necessarily work.
No, I don't think it does. The efficiency is huge. But scale, which I think is really so important.
So it's scale that matters more?
Yeah, I think so.
So say a digitized Lloyd's market, we're a 50, 60 billion pound market now. If it was fully digitized, of course, it could scale to 200-300 billion quite quickly. And then, of course, the expenses wouldn't matter very much.
I certainly think for part of the market, if you get that right, that is the opportunity in front, particularly when you look at anything that falls under the delegated authority. Once you've got better seamless ingestion of data, more controlled and responsive underwriting as a result, yeah, definitely that gives you the scale.
Certainly on that delegated side, turning the thing to a real-time view would be, that's the sort of holy grail. Are we much closer to that now, surely?
We're closer, but I think we're still a...
The old quarterly bordereaux are still with us, are they?
On our platform, we certainly get the real-life quote, bind, and exposure data, but then you've got to match it with everything else. So I think we're closer as a market, but the finish line's still a way off, I think.
When you do get those expense savings, which probably... So you're saying they really mostly come through scale.
Yeah.
You can write 5 times as much with the same amount of resource.
Yeah.
What sort of reduction do you get?
Without wishing to be too evasive, we will get more out of the reduction when we understand the interaction between risk and claims data better. So I think the improvement in the underwriting margin will come from the better data that we get.
Right. Okay. So it's not actually about what the platform costs you and whether you can earn it back quickly or not. It's far more about what it's the insights it's going to give you to become a better underwriter.
Absolutely. And if we get more interactivity and, dare I say, dynamic pricing, which would be a bit more of a holy grail, particularly on that product that I mentioned. If you could move into that where you know where your demand is moving on a live basis and you can adjust pricing accordingly, that's a prize worth going after, I think.
Sounds sort of fun. Do you just sort of have visions of sitting like a Bond villain, you know, pushing levers and pressing buttons?
I'm not sure Tom Squires has got a white cap, but I mean, I just think it offers a lot of scope and opportunity. And again, we're still really at the foothills on this journey, but there's a long way to go.
That's really exciting sounding. You're saying this is foothills, but it's already quite a not insignificant proportion of your business.
No, it's not. And actually, I think we've since inception, we've done 370 odd million of gross premium under the platform, which is astounded me. I didn't realize it had grown to that much.
Well, well done. Well done. You're a Lloyd's business. Will you always be a Lloyd's only business in the future, do you think? Does it come a point when to continue to grow or, you know, geographically or by certain lines, do you think there might be an Aegis Insurance Company Limited somewhere?
So I think you've touched upon a perennial favourite of the annual strategy review, which is, do we need an alternate platform? And we keep coming back to the same conclusion that we don't. But as you observe, we're deeply wedded to Lloyd's. So we need that capability to match what we need to do. I think if it was not just in terms of growth, I think we can do that within the Lloyd's platform. But certainly if we're thinking about capability and bearing in mind that we have to interact with our distribution partners, we need Lloyd's to match certainly what they're doing around Blueprint 2 with what we will need in the future.
So it's really contingent on Lloyd's continuing to develop in the way that it needs to.
Absolutely,
and at the moment, you don't see that it's not doing that.
But I mean, never say never. I mean, the underwriting opportunity in front of us at the moment doesn't require us to go and see company paper or anything like that.
It's really good to hear. And so you're a Lloyd's man through and through, and you're going to continue on that journey with the rest of the market as far as it can go.
Let's hope so.
Excellent. You've been one of the top performing syndicates for as long as the numbers go back. I'm sure the first couple of years are probably, you know, they're slightly immaterial, probably have over 100 combined ratio at the beginning, as they're bound to be. But certainly when we look over a 10-year period, you're absolutely in the top quartile. And also in those kind of quadrant style analyses that we see, you know, that you're getting the profitability without the volatility as well. How do you do it, Alex? Because I think everyone would like to know.
Isn't that a bit like asking Colonel Sanders what's in his secret recipe?
Oh, it's just salt and pepper, isn't it?
Bit of sugar, probably. I think focus, I think, is really key. And we've been able to focus on underwriting. And we haven't had distraction of doing other things. We have a very stable and understanding capital provider in the mutual who've been with us every step of the journey. And they've allowed us to plan bottom up and not necessarily top down.
And they haven't been in a hurry.
No, they have definitely not. They are very patient, and they are, after all, trying to complete a mutual mission of the sustainable risk transfer for their members. So they're looking to us for a return through cycle and hopefully no surprises along the way. So we very much adhered to that mission. And I think if you've got that in the background and you're not distracted by buying businesses or managing more than one platform, I think you can very much focus on the underwriting. And we've been an underwriting-led business, and I think that's paid dividends for us.
So their mission has always been, you know, we want you to give us diversification and a return for our members, and they've never asked you to do anything else.
Exactly. And I think helps that they're obviously insurance people, so they understand the cycle. So in 2017, which, let's face it, was probably the nadir of the soft market, they didn't say, well, how about another 10%? So, you know, good, sensible capital provider is essential in this mix.
Nice to have somebody you can go to and say, look, we're going to have to shrink everything by 10% this year because it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And they're perfectly understandable.
Very understandable. Yeah.
You've been at Aegis for 20 years. And you've got a large new cohort that only in the last couple of years. How do you expect them to have 20-year careers like yours? I mean, obviously, yours, we hope, is going to go on for quite a lot longer than 20 years.
It needs to. I mean, against the backdrop of the war on talent, which I think is very alive, certainly in the London market, and we haven't been immune to that, pegged onto the culture piece that is one of our strategic priorities is talent. And as you reference, we've got to sheep dip in the Aegis Orange, that new cohort, for our future success. That's absolutely critical. And I like the fact you reference my career, because careers is something I talk about at Aegis London, not jobs. And we've had good success for a small business, really good success on moving people between roles and disciplines. And long may that continue. And back to this new cohort we've got, a lot of the jobs that are within Aegis today didn't even exist in Aegis 3 or 4 years ago. So I think that gives us tremendous scope. But there is a lot of work to do. We've got some fairly senior, long-tenured people reaching the end of their careers, and we had one earlier this year. So there is a lot to pass on.
What's in that orange dye that you want to dye in the wool of people?
I think empowerment is right in there. And I know it's quite clear, but a lot of people say, well, we empower everyone. Well, we do like to empower people, and particularly our underwriters, to say no. Very easy for an underwriter to say yes, but it's a lot harder to say no. But we like to empower anybody across Aegis, whatever their function. We need a framework around people to make sure we know what's going on. But really, trust and empowerment, measure that up with a bit of openness, quite a bit of transparency.
Trust and verify. And I suppose you can have transparency if people know that they're not going to get shot if they confess to something that they've done wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it goes back to the old underwriting cycle management. In an ideal world when the market's in the tank, you want your underwriters off playing golf or something else, or as little as possible.
You can't afford to do that, no.
But there's a great understanding here that growth is not an imperative, particularly on the underwriting side, because of our single P&L. We all get fed from the same trough.
So does that mean with a single P&L, everyone's looking out for everyone else, and also you don't want to let any crazy people in some esoteric class over in the corner who've lost everyone's bonus this year?
And absolutely. And just this very morning, in the big room down the hall, we have our monthly underwriting meeting where all the underwriters get to look at each other and support each other or otherwise. And I think that's an incredible part of the glue of Aegis. that people do have a really good sense of what's going on across the business.
So it sounds like you need to also have a robust kind of culture where people have got thick enough skins to be able to take criticism as well as give it out to others, one presumes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think we've got elephant-type hides, but we need to be grown up and we need to be realistic with each other. But we like to do that with an added dose of niceness.
Sounds like a good formula, but all I can say is that it does seem to have been working over the last decade and a bit.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and it all starts, I think, with good people. If we start with good people, it makes life a lot easier.
Yeah. And what's the sense in terms of where you could be in 5 or 10 years' time? You're going to say that it's dependent on market conditions. If
Absolutely.
The market continued to be favourable in the way that it is at the moment, might you be able to double in size, perhaps, in the next 5 years?
I mean, it's entirely possible. It's certainly not in a dusty plan that I've got in the bottom drawer that we're going to do that. But I think scale has been important to us, but also balance is important to us. Balance between short and long tail, between cat and non-cat. So if we're going to scale some of our other lines, we may need other mechanisms to be able to do that. And we do write business on behalf of other people. So not only do we follow consortium in the DU portfolio that I mentioned, but we also lead a lot of consortium for our own account.
I've come to the end of most of my questions. I think I wouldn't want to go over them all over again, but what's sort of final parting shot from you, Alex, in terms of what we should be expecting from you in 2023 and what you're expecting, what you're most looking forward to doing in 23?
Well, I think 23 has come as a modest surprise to us that the market for the products we write is a lot better than we'd planned. I don't think that prompts anything too dramatic, but it does mean there's a bit more in our growth story. There'll be more from us on the digital front. We've just rolled out our claims portal on Opal, and there'll be more products in the pipeline. But ultimately, we've got to deliver a good performance because that's how we're measured. So we're focused on that.
Well, great. Well, I'll let you get on with it. I must make you commit to coming on the show at some point this time next year or a bit later to have an update.
Well, I'd be thrilled to do that. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this program. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry.
The Voice of Insurance podcast is produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise scale underwriting through a single pane of glass.
Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.